From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. All throughout the country, states are trying to decide whether to expand their Medicaid programs for the poor. It's a key component of the Affordable Care Act, but conservatives in red states are uneasy. It's a state's choice, and some Republican governors have gone along with the expansion. Others have crafted their own plans. Still others have had a difficult time getting their plans approved by Republican-controlled legislatures. That's our situation here in Utah, where lawmakers rejected Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah proposal. So lawmakers have come up with their own plans, more than one, in fact, and the latest was overwhelmingly rejected by a Republican caucus in a closed-door meeting yesterday. Today in the program, we're talking about the political maneuvering in this story and asking what happens next, after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was 2012 when the Supreme Court gave individual states the choice of whether to expand their Medicaid coverage to the poor. It was a mandate under the original provisions of the Affordable Care Act. The court made it optional. And Republicans in red states have resisted the expansion, but some have gone along. Others have crafted their own plans. Utah Governor Gary Herbert put together his own proposal called Healthy Utah. He was able to get it through the Senate, but leaders in the House of Representatives rejected it. So lawmakers were given the job of coming up with another plan, one that might get through a reluctant House. The latest, a plan called Utah Access Plus, was formally presented to a closed-door Republican caucus yesterday, and it was soundly defeated. The plan included what some saw as an onerous provider tax. House Speaker Greg Hughes said he needed 38 votes out of the 63 Republicans. He got 7. So it's now apparently back to the drawing board. 3 years on, and Utah still has no plan to expand Medicaid to the 125,000 or so without coverage. So we're talking about this story today. Joining us first on the program is Senator Brian Shiozawa. He's an emergency room doctor, a Republican member of the state Senate. He represents District 8. We should say he sponsored Governor Herbert's Healthy Utah plan in a 2014 Senate bill. He was one of the so-called Gang of Six Republican leaders tasked with drafting a new compromise bill for Medicaid expansion in Utah. And Senator Shiozawa, thank you very much for joining us here in the studio.
It's good to be with you.
Well, let me begin, I guess, with I'm trying to understand your support for this latest proposal. You've talked about your concerns with taxing people who provide the care. That's precisely what the proposal does. So why go along with it?
Well, this was a bill that is a compromise bill. And I personally had a lot of concerns about this. Yeah. And ultimately, it came down to this. We have an issue of a coverage gap in the state of Utah with literally thousands of Utahns without medical access because they have no medical insurance and who fall in this coverage gap caused by the Supreme Court's decision. Now, the funding mechanism is the contentious part of this agreement. Yeah. And I clearly made it public as well as candidly to the speaker that I disagreed with this approach, but for the greater good of the Medicaid expansion, I reluctantly went along with this. And deservedly so, got a lot of comments from my fellow physicians on this.
Who aren't crazy about the idea, right?
I would say that's putting it lightly.
Right.
And so there were some clear problems I worry about. Residents who come out of residency and look to Utah and say, gee whiz, if I come here, I'm going to be paying money that I would never have to pay in other states. And why would I want to do that? I look at retaining doctors here who don't even take Medicaid clients and who would be taxed. Yeah. I worry about retaining those physicians, about charity care. So there was a huge number of concerns on this. And yet when it came down to it, it was either this way or no bill at all. And so that was a tough decision for me.
And so for you, you would rather have something to at least move this. I'm guessing you probably figured it, having heard from people who were opposed to it. I'm guessing you probably were not terribly surprised by the fact that it was defeated yesterday. I'm guessing you expected that, but you were hoping at least to get something on the table to address eventually this gap. Is that fair to say?
Well, even so, when we came out of the original agreements, we had the hope at least that the Speaker and House leadership finally saying, we will at least agree to an expansion of Medicaid, which they hadn't done before,
right,
that even with the really problematic provider tax, that this moved the ball forward and would get the people covered. And then also with the promise that we would look at this annually and adjust up and down the provider rates, maybe even someday eliminate those. But those were some of the ideas. But the biggest and the greatest good is to achieve some sort of coverage gap for this vulnerable population, and frankly also to get the federal monies that would draw in thousands of Utah jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars to the state.
What do you make of this accusation that has come from some who have suggested that this was – one physician in particular told our own Andrea Smarden, Dr. Kyle Bradford Jones – he wondered whether the House leadership really even wanted the plan to succeed in the first place. So there's been this suggestion from some lawmakers, too, who have said it's just a poison pill. There was no intent on their part, on the part of Speaker Hughes, to actually pass something like this. He knew he wouldn't have the votes going on. What do you make of that accusation, that they didn't really expect to win, that it was a poison pill?
Well, first of all, we spent 6 months in negotiating this, a lot of time, and heard a lot of experts, became very well informed on it. We met personally with Secretary Burwell to talk about waivers. That was a lot of effort. I can't speak for the House leadership in terms of what their motives or intents ultimately were. I think the governor and myself especially went in with the hopes that we could craft a compromise that would move the Medicaid coverage ahead. And that was our single and only objective.
What's the difference between the House and the Senate? Senate overwhelmingly Republican, conservative like yourself. Why would the Senate be more inclined to compromise on this issue? Do you think you've come to understand – I'm not asking you to speak for the House or the House leadership, but do you think you've come to understand the House's resistance to this?
Well, I'm certainly impressed that there are two chambers in the legislature now and that we have to work together in order to advance any notion. And I will say that both in public and closed discussions with the Senate, there's a lot of objection to Obamacare and to the notion of the Medicaid expansion. But fortunately, the discussion has prevailed of the greater good of the coverage gap as well as the federal monies that we're going to get back to the state of Utah, both in the short term and in the long term. And so I think the Senate was able to take this forward. And I hope that I was able to help champion that cause in the Senate. And it was a very good, deliberative conversation that we had.
I wanted to ask one of your colleagues, Democratic Senator Jim DeBacchus, told Andrea Smarden that he said this. He said, we're trying to make every contorting possibility to meet the ideological needs of the extremists in the Republican Party. I wanted to get you to comment on this idea that this issue is being driven by the reluctance of a few select, in his words, extremists on the right. Will you react to that?
Well, I think Senator DeBacchus always has some very colorful descriptions of the House and some of the discussions they've had. I will say that I do think there's not only financial concerns on the part of the House, but there are probably philosophical and ideological concerns as well. When I was testifying and presenting this particular bill, both during the regular session and then this adaptation at the Health Reform Task Force, I remember some House basically representatives and their constituents saying there's able-bodied population out there. If they would work, they wouldn't need this sort of assistance from the government and concerns about that. So I think there's some philosophical concerns on their part. And I'll grant you that Medicaid is not a perfect system, and it is in need of reform. And in fact, that's one of the positive things I'm going to look at going forth in this session and others in the future is how we can better serve the Medicaid population, increase quality and access, but also keep our costs down and have firmer links to primary care and keep these patients out of the ER unless absolutely necessary and still get them good care and yet keep our costs down.
What do you make of the effort by Speaker Hughes to keep the issue from coming to a vote on the floor? And not only that, I think more broadly, I'm interested in what you make of the context of the meeting yesterday. Closed door, 3 hours, Democrats not involved at all in the presentation of the proposal. How do you react to that? There's been some criticism of that, leaving certain people out of the process at this point.
I am strongly in favor of transparency, and even during the last session, one of my hopes was that the House would just let the bill come to the floor and let every House member, Republican or Democrat, vote on it in public, yes or no. And there were attempts to get it out of committee where it stalled and to bring it to the floor, but really to have that formal vote. And that applies to this special session as well. Without the bill coming forth from the House, there was no chance really for a special session. It would be pointless because even if it did make it through the Senate, again, the House wouldn't even have an opportunity to meet on it. In terms of what goes on in the House, that's their business. That's the House rules, and I don't make the rules. I can't comment on the rules. I do know that the Democrats in the House felt very strongly they were excluded on that. And if I were a Democrat, I might have felt the same way in terms of not being involved in a discussion on such a really important issue.
Let's talk about what happens next. You've said you have some ideas. Do you have some particular ideas for the way forward on this?
One of my concerns is if there is, in fact, hope for a Medicaid expansion here in the state of Utah, we've tried this really I first ran a bill 2 years ago and succeeded in getting a partial expansion done, but the HHS would not agree to that to get the enhanced match.
Right.
And that was really an ideal solution. I still think that would have been great, but other states have tried it and have also been similarly turned down.
Because the federal government is saying we want all or nothing.
Exactly.
Right.
And so then we ran Healthy Utah, and that was a good bill. And I still think it has lots of merit with the waivers that we got, the private option, and we achieved the coverage gap and we got the enhanced match and we would have gotten all the federal monies. So it really was a great, I think, way to go forward. And so where do we go? I think we have to sit back and decide if there is even an appetite in an election year to consider a Medicaid expansion. I'm sure some of my Democrat colleagues will want to run a bill with a Medicaid expansion. I can't predict great outcomes for that, but I'm sure that will be one of their objectives.
Why, because your Republican colleagues may wait to see what happens with the election?
I know there's a lot of concerns about 2016, but then there were a lot of concerns about 2012 and King v. Burwell as well. So I'll let you decide, you know, how much validity that has. One of the things that I think we'll see is even with a Republican administration, let's say a Republican in the White House and a Republican-controlled Senate and House, there are so many states that have already embraced the Affordable Care Act and specifically the Medicaid expansion and seen their uninsured rates drop and the economic benefits that I'm not sure that there would be an overturn of the Affordable Care Act now because it's been in place for so long. You know, Utah now has a 13.2%, I believe, uninsured rate, and we are now almost 2 percentage points higher than the national average of uninsured, and surrounding states like Washington and Oregon are down to 6 and 8% uninsured. Even Arkansas went to 11% uninsured with the Medicaid expansion. So I don't know that there will be the appetite, even in Congress, with a Republican administration to overturn this, but that's speculation.
Yeah. How important is this to you to get this expansion taken care of as a physician?
Well, this is this is heartbreaking to see it happen this way. And I guess the biggest concern I have is for the people of the state of Utah. And there are literally thousands of Utah citizens who will suffer as a result of us not passing something. And we need to do that. We need to get something done. And there will probably be something like the Utah Cares or similar brought up this next session that will do just that. It will do something.
Some sort of stopgap thing?
Well, it will probably be less than what we're what we've tried to propose and basically similar to what was proposed last session but never made it out of the House to the Senate.
I can't tell if you're hopeful or not.
Well, I'm optimistic that hopefully we'll work something out. I wish we could get the Medicaid expansion. It seems to represent the best of a lot of things. We get the enhanced federal match, all the hundreds of millions of dollars coming back to the state of Utah, creating thousands of jobs. We'd alleviate the medical issues and enhance the access for thousands of Utahns who currently don't have that, and some of whom I'll see tonight in the ER when I'm down there, and who really shouldn't be there. That drives the costs up for you and me and our health care premiums and our health care costs and copays to unsustainable levels. And we have a chance to flatten out that cost trajectory to help people and bring money into the state. Now, you show me something that makes more sense than that, and I'll embrace that.
Senator Brian Chiozawa represents Utah's 8th District in the state Senate. He helped draft the recently rejected Utah Access Plus plan to expand Medicaid in the state. Of course, sponsored Governor Gary Herbert's Healthy Utah Plan in 2014 in the Senate there. He joined us here in the studio. Senator, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
And we'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the political machinations, really, behind the efforts in this state to work around one of the key provisions of Obamacare, Medicaid expansion. Now, conservative lawmakers and governors around the country have been resisting this expansion. Some have crafted their own plan. Some have actually agreed to the expansion. Yesterday, Republicans in this state overwhelmingly rejected the latest proposal, one drafted by their fellow Republicans. And so we're talking about that plan and some of the others and asking what happens next. We had on the program Republican Senator Brian Chiozawa earlier. Joining us now on the program is Robert Gerke, who reports on government for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrea Smartin, also with us, of course, covers healthcare and business for KUER News. Andrea, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's so maybe we can just start with the meeting yesterday. 3-hour, closed door meeting. What was the secrecy about? Why not? And of course, they left Democrats out of this proposal. So how did what was that about?
Well, traditionally, when the Republican caucuses get a sensitive issue like this, it's not unusual for them to close their caucus and discuss it in private. The argument in favor of it, I guess, is that they can discuss things frankly without, you know, the public and the media kind of, you know, getting reporting on what they're saying or, you know, and so they can kind of have a frank airing of grievances and things like that and a more lively exchange. The speaker said that, you know, the speaker said yesterday after the vote that he thinks that every member is going to have to be held accountable for their vote and answer to their constituents, which does get a little tricky, I think, because we don't know how they voted on this issue. You do have this
You suggested we could ask each one.
Yeah.
Right? We know that there are 7 that rejected and 2 of them were the Speaker and the House Majority Leader himself. Yeah. So that leaves 5 if we
Who are the 5?
So he's saying, I'm not telling. You go figure that out yourselves.
Right, yeah. Right. So, you know, it is one of these things where the Speaker says it's a generational issue. This is a major issue for the state. And yeah, if you're the average Utah voter at this point, you don't really know how your member voted unless you go ask them and they are willing to tell you. And so there is a little bit of cloak and dagger secrecy to it. And you kind of are left wondering what exactly the arguments are against it and who made what arguments and where they are. But that's the way they've been. You know, the Senate always closes their caucus, and the House has done it when they get a sensitive issue like this one.
I don't understand what the speaker figured he had to gain going into this meeting yesterday. I mean, it has to have been clear for some time now the fairly intense resistance to this provider tax. I can't imagine he expected he would get 38 votes.
No, I don't think he did. I think he also took a lot of heat last session when Healthy Utah didn't come up to a vote, you know. So you have to kind of run the process through. Senator Niederhauser, when I talked to him about it before their caucus, said
this
that
is the president of the Senate.
Yeah, President Niederhauser said that his sort of goal in this is trying to find out where the support is, if there is enough support to kind of continue down this path and maybe make refinements to the proposal that was on the table. So I guess there could have been an element of that. You know, when you have this, something that kind of splats with such a thud as this in the House, you know, 7 votes is, you know, they just missed it by 31. That's not really close. You know, so you kind of – it sends a pretty clear signal. There is not any support for this, and they need to move on to other ideas or other proposals.
The Speaker did make the argument that when they initially came up with the idea that he really believed – that the medical community would get behind it, that if they spread out
the risk,
as he calls it, the risk that the cost of this could grow. So if many different provider groups are bearing this risk, then and this is something that many of them have said that they want a Medicaid expansion and they want these federal dollars to come into the state. So if this is something that they want, why wouldn't they support it?
But I don't understand why he thinks they would support it as opposed to taxpayers supporting it, because that's essentially what he's saying, right? Is you, the healthcare providers, if we're going to spread the risk, you take the risk, not taxpayers. That's the point he's making, right?
And the risk and the reward. I mean, the benefits of this are going to flow to hospitals. They're going to flow to doctors. They're going to flow to pharmaceutical companies.
So there's a reward component.
So and their argument, their contention is that for every new dollar they're going to receive from an insured individual, they're asking for 7 cents, asking to pay 7 cents, you know, of that to kind of keep this money flowing. He said that he was and this is actually a pretty valid point. During the session, these groups were all behind Healthy Utah. They all supported Medicaid expansion, provided that taxpayers pick up the tab for it. The legislature, especially in the House, were saying, well, there's a lot of risk involved here. There's a lot of, you know, what if costs skyrocket? We don't, you know, then we're on the hook for it. And the groups all said, no, you know, it's OK. These aren't real concerns. Now they kind of shift the risk to the providers, and they're all worried about the risk and the you know, if costs explode and they're on the hook for all this money. So it changed their mind. And as Speaker Hughes said, I think yesterday, he said everybody loves Medicaid expansion until they have to pay for it.
Yeah, and I think it was interesting. Last week they had a public hearing on this. And this was the chance for the provider community and the public to come out and say what they thought about it. And this went on for hours. There was 2 overflow rooms. There was a lot of people wanted to talk about this and especially talk about their issues with this proposal, especially this idea of a provider tax.
Right.
And it just was so interesting for me to watch, because over 3 years, we have seen all of these groups coming up to the Capitol. Whenever this issue comes up, there are all these advocates that say we need Medicaid expansion, and that includes this medical community who's been part of the big advocacy group. And lawmakers have had to sort of sit and listen to lots of people say, why can't you expand Medicaid? People need this. And then at this meeting last week, all they heard was, you know, lots of criticism of this concept, and it was basically echoing a lot of the things that they've been saying. So kind of flipped it on its head there.
So that gets to Speaker Hughes's point.
Yeah. Yeah. And the, you know, the doctors, the hospitals, all of them basically said, yeah, we want Medicaid expansion. We just don't want to be on the hook for the cost of it. So that, you know, that leaves you scratching your head. Where do we go at this point?
Not just the cost of it, but that cost is not at some fixed rate that could go up.
And they want a ceiling. Like the hospital association said they're willing to pay about $25 million But they want a ceiling. So if, you know, if the enrollments go up, if costs go up, if the federal reimbursement comes down, they're not left holding the bag on this.
What are the chances that anyone will be left holding the bag? I mean, and maybe we should explain the way it works. So the federal government is covering the expansion match mm-hmm. until 2020, mm-hmm. 100%.
Yeah.
At that point, it becomes 90% the federal government, and the state's got to come up with the 10%. And that's what they're worried about, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans in the House have said they, you know, talked with Paul Ryan, congressman, you know, who's in charge of Ways and Means, and he said it's unsustainable. You know, there have been other, you know, members of Congress who said this 90-10 match is too rich. They can't keep it up. And so the concern is, well, if it goes down to 20 or if it goes down to 80-20, your costs for the state double at that point. You know, what are we going to be left with all of this extra expense? You know, and I suppose it's a possibility. You know, Congress can change the matches how they see fit. The fact of the matter is, at this point, Utahns are paying into this fund through the taxes that have been assessed through Obamacare to the tune of, I believe, it's something like $800 million a year, and it has been since the bill passed. And so you know, there's money that's flowing out of the state that we're not going to get back at this point. Based on where on the state of play at this point, you know, the defeat of this last night and the state of play on Medicaid expansion generally.
I want to seems like the big question is, I mean, one of the things that Senator Chiesel was wondering, was talking about, how much of this, if you do the calculus, sort of the political calculus, how much of this is a philosophical opposition to Obamacare in general? And how much of this is a legitimate cost concern? I'm guessing they can fold them all into the same thing, but have you been able to sense how much of this is just philosophical opposition to Obamacare in general?
I think there is a diversity of opinions in among the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans. I think they kind of all – there's probably overlap, but there are some who are adamantly opposed to Medicaid expansion. There are some who say it's not sustainable, and there's some who say it's – you know, that the state shouldn't be paying for it. So – and then with this new plan – some of them believe that the taxes are the issue and some of the unintended consequences, like Senator Chiesel was talking about, how it affects rural doctors, how it affects, you know, providers generally. So I think there are opinions kind of across the board. But I think there is a solid camp, a solid block of votes in both the House and the Senate Republican caucus who are going to vote no regardless. Representative Jake Andrick, for example, when he was a freshman up there and Medicaid expansion was first on the table, sponsored legislation that said no, period, end of sentence, right? We're not going to take any of this money. They kind of toned that down, pressure from the governor's office. They agreed to kind of say, well, we're not going to take it. The governor wouldn't take Medicaid expansion without, you know, the consent basically of the legislature. And so that's how we got into this position right now, because otherwise the governor could just say, yeah, we're going to take the money, you know, and be done with that, like a number of other states have.
That's how it works in most states.
That's how most states have done it, especially Democratic states.
And I think it's interesting because it does sort of point out divisions in the Republican Party, right? We're seeing different positions from the governor and I guess the majority of the Senate compared to a block in the House, so we're seeing differences there, and I thought it was interesting the way the governor responded after this decision by the House. I mean, I guess it was his spokesperson, Amy Edwards. I have the quote here, the statement they put out last night: "The poorest among us will continue to struggle until Utah leaders can find agreement on this difficult issue." And she says, "Unfortunately, the House of Representatives defeated Healthy Utah and continues to push back against other proposals, even those crafted by their own legislative leadership." So kind of tough words for the House Republicans there. I feel like we're seeing differences of opinion here among the Republicans.
Do we have a sense of if you were to take this to the floor? Would it pass in the House?
No.
How big is the block? Is it big enough to
Oh no, I certainly not this. I mean, we've had two votes. We had a vote during the session, essentially on Healthy Utah, sort of a de facto vote on Healthy Utah, and I got 22 votes, including the 12 Democrats. 12 Democrats and 10 Republicans is all Healthy Utah got. This right. one, you know, we're down now to 7 Republican votes in the House. Even if you have all 12 Democrats, you're only halfway there. So right, yeah. There's this bill is not going to.
So these aren't procedural maneuvers. This is the if you take it to the floor, it would not pass.
It would die yeah. resoundingly. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it sort of points out that they've got to kind of come up with something probably fairly significantly different, particularly on the funding mechanism for it. So one of the things that came up during the reform task force, one of the options that has been tried in other states is have hospitals pay the full freight for this thing because they're the ones who get the most benefit out of it. You don't have the sort of the consequences with the doctors that Senator Shiozawa was talking about.
And then you have only one block in opposition.
And you only have one block in opposition.
Of them, I guess, yeah.
Pretty powerful block. But, yeah, you know, for example, I mean, hospitals are the ones who are providing most of this uncompensated care. As Senator Shiozawa said, you, if you don't have insurance, you put it off, you go to the emergency room, it's your only option, right? They're the providers of last resort, and they're required under federal law to care for these people, anybody who comes in the door. So, you know, the University of Utah Hospital, for example, has something in the neighborhood of about $150 million a year in uncompensated care, and would see that number drop significantly because they would these people coming in for treatment would have insurance, and probably healthcare costs would drop significantly overall because people would be going into their doctor earlier for preventative care and so forth.
Is anyone thinking about that? Is that being floated out there? Is just by teasing out that one provider
just
for the tax?
I think it's probably a non-starter.
Well, but that is what's going on in much of the country. I mean, a hospital tax to pay for Medicaid expansion has been done around the country in different places. This idea of taxing individual doctors,
I don't think
that anyone has done that in the country. So that's unprecedented.
And one of the issues that Senator Shiozawa touched on, particularly, again, as it pertains to doctors, is you can't say that because – Doug, you're a doctor who takes Medicaid and Andrea is a doctor who doesn't take Medicaid. We're going to tax Doug and not Andrea. The federal law says we have to tax them all the same. So you do run into this situation where some doctors aren't going to actually see any additional money coming in, but they're going to be expected to pay the additional licensing fees to fund this program.
Let's take a few calls here. Don is with us in Ogden. Don, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hey, Doug, thank you for having me. I'm a provider in Ogden. I just wanted to comment about the panel's kind of disconnect, why providers support Medicaid expansion, but they were so much against the tax. I think we all realize we're going to be seeing patients in the emergency room, whether they're insured or whether they have Medicaid anyway. And I think Medicaid expansion is necessary. But you have to ultimately understand this is a broken system. When patients don't have any skin in the game to not use the emergency room, they continue using it. And with this expansion of a provider tax, there is no burden shared by patients at all. No ability to change their behavior that lends them going to the emergency room. Providers already take a discounted payment on Medicaid patients for those that see them. So I think that's why providers were so opposed to the tax, but they understand the reality. You're either going to see them as uninsured patients in the emergency room or as Medicaid patients. And then the last comment is, as a federal system of rewarding the state, that's a limited venture. No one foresees what the cost will be 10 to 15 years of Medicaid mm-hmm. expansion, where there could be a burgeoning number of patients in this category. And the providers were concerned a tax of $5,000 the first year would grow without any restraint. I think those are the two concerns that were shared by providers.
You want to respond to that?
Well, the one point about the reimbursement rates for Medicaid. Under this proposal, what they were seeking to do was draw down the federal money, use that to subsidize private insurance. So it wouldn't be the Medicaid reimbursement rate. It would be a private insurance rate for these providers. I guess the other issue that he raised dealt with, you know, the cost overruns, you know, which we have seen in states like Arkansas and I believe Illinois, and you know, there's real concern about that. The other issue I think he talked about was changing behavior. And there was a provision in this bill that was kind of unique and kind of interesting, that they were going to, for the sort of the lowest income or the most medical needy people, they were going to put them in, you know, these ACOs where they were going to get basically counselors to kind of keep them, you know, keep them up to date on their you know, to sort of shepherd them through the healthcare process, you know, because it can be a little mind-boggling. I think we've all been there. To make sure that they're getting the care they need at each step of the way, getting the follow-up care they need, to try to kind of keep the preventative element of it high and the emergency room element of it low.
I think there was also a piece of it that kind of penalizes people for using the emergency room when it's not necessary. I think it would not be covered at the same rate, or there would be more cost sharing. I can't remember the details, but I do remember there was a piece
to deal with that.
Emergency room use when it's not necessary. Yeah.
Don, glad you called. Thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Here's a question that comes from Janae in Salt Lake City. Does Utah Access Plus, does that make healthy Utah look more attractive now? I think that's one of the questions that has come up is was there some sinister motive to on the part of those who may have supported the governor's plan to mm-hmm. put forth a fairly onerous proposal to make the governor's proposal look good now?
Well, I as Andrea mentioned, the governor's statement from the spokeswoman last night, he's back to saying Healthy Utah was the best plan all along, and he thinks that's the one that they should have passed in the first place. I don't know that this generates more support for it, though. I think you've probably got the same concerns from the same people. And this, you know, like I said, 10 votes in the House when it came up in March leaves it still well short of where it needs to be.
So that doesn't change anything.
Yeah, they were talking about some ideas, some alternate proposals, basically going back to the Utah Cares plan that Representative Dunnigan sponsored last session that doesn't. It's not a true Medicaid expansion. It's sort of a state-level Medicaid expansion where you kind of take on these people that are up to 100% of the poverty. You don't get the same amount of federal dollars. It's actually more expensive for the state, covers fewer people, and draws down less federal money. That's the knock on it, I guess. The benefit that they touted was that, you know, it's something the state can control. It has more flexibility for them. They're not tied into this sort of long-term federal commitment under Obamacare that they would be if they went to the 138% and did a true Medicaid expansion.
Go ahead.
I just think that the political climate is also becoming, I think it seems, less and less receptive to a Medicaid expansion, even the governor's plan. As there's been pressure, there's the group Americans for Prosperity, funded by the Koch brothers, this national group that now has a Utah chapter, and they have really been putting on the pressure in the last couple of months, sending out mailers, contacting constituents and saying, don't let your legislator pass this, what I think they were calling it, a sick tax, that if you tax doctors, it's going to mean that it costs more for sick people. It's basically a tax on the sick that it's going to get passed on. So there's been a lot of political pressure, and I think that's making conservatives even less likely to want to support something like this right now, and with an election year coming up as well.
Well, Senator Shiozawa was saying that one of the things he thinks may happen is that now they will default to this Utah Cares program, mm-hmm. which he thinks may mean that expansion is done for in this state.
Yeah, I mean, if they do go that route, and you know, we heard from Speaker Hughes last night some suggestion that might be an avenue they could. The House did pass that. I think it got something like 52 votes. Mm-hmm. You know, so it did pass the House, and if the Senate was willing to go along with that as opposed to Healthy Utah, we probably would have had that in place by now. But yeah, Speaker Hughes was making suggestions that they might go that direction. Francis Gibson, Representative Gibson, who's the majority whip, was suggesting that might be something that he could support. The speaker said, and I don't remember his exact quote, but he said there is a political will in the legislature and in the House to cover Utah's low income and needy population. They just have to kind of resolve these concerns that have been raised by various members to do that.
And they said he mentioned that he wanted to be free of these federal requirements, that all the requirements that come along with accepting federal funds. So I don't know what that means, if we would not be accepting any federal funds, or if that would be a lower match rate where instead of 90%, it's 70%, where we don't have to meet it. Utah doesn't have to meet as much of these federal requirements in order to get the money.
Yeah. It seems like a huge question, because Senator Shiozawa was talking about the fact that they were trying to negotiate something less than an all or nothing match with the federal government. The feds were unwilling to do it. They've, in fact, they've been pretty resolute about not doing that.
Yeah, I think the contention from the federal side is that the law doesn't really give them the flexibility to kind of improvise and do an 85 or 80 or, you know, whatever percent match, or
give a 90% have to go all the way, right?
Right.
If you want this money.
Right. Well, and if they start saying, well, Utah, we understand that you guys don't like the Medicaid expansion, but we're still going to give you 90%, you're going to have 49 other states lining up saying, hey, wait a second, let's do it this way, and then the cost of the program goes through the roof, right? At that point, it does become completely unsustainable. So, I think the Utah Cares program that, like I said, Representative Dunnigan proposed last time, and they're kind of, you know, hinting there might be an option this time. They get 70 cents on the dollar in federal money as opposed to the 90 cents on the dollar. And so, you know, you're covering a smaller population and you're doing it with more state funding.
Robert Gerke is with us from the Salt Lake Tribune. Andrea Smarden from our KUER news department, covering efforts, both of them in Utah, to expand Medicaid or not. It'll be interesting to see what happens. We need to take a break, though. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the efforts in this state to work around one of those key provisions of Obamacare, that is Medicaid expansion. Conservative lawmakers and governors around the country have been resisting that, trying to come up with their own plans. Yesterday, Republicans overwhelmingly rejected the latest proposal, one, in fact, drafted by Republicans. So we're talking about that plan and talking about what may happen next in this story with Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune and Andrea Smarden from KUER News. Robert Gerke, I wanted to ask you about one of the things you've been writing about, and that is the potential conflicts of interest among lawmakers. 21 House members, 14 senators have some kind of connection to the medical field.
Yeah, and they vary from person to person. I mean, like that Senator Dr. Shiazawa on here. He's an emergency room doctor. You have, I think there were four or five doctors. You have just people who are married to doctors. You have one of the other things, hospitals have these local boards, you know, and they'll frequently put legislators on their local boards. And so, you know, the potential for conflict is there, and it varies in the severity or the, you know, gravity of it. And there's really no direct correlation, to be clear. I mean, Dr. Shiazawa, for example, is a doctor. The Utah Medical Association, which represents doctors, was adamantly opposed to this and lobbying hard against it. He was a supporter of it. So, you know, there's not a clear direction.
Sure.
For example, during the Healthy Utah proposal, as we discussed, the Medical Association, Hospital Association, and others supported the expansion, and a lot of the members who were, you know, in the House who have these ties to the medical industry opposed it. So, you know, it's not a clear-cut direct correlation, but it's something that I think was worth drawing some attention to, so constituents can look at their individual representative and maybe understand that that might have some influence on how they view this issue and how they vote.
I wanted to ask about, Andrea, one of the things you've been reporting on during this process is the public input.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, the committee room, the Capitol packed, needed two overflow rooms. I mean, what are they hearing from people who are not covered, for groups who advocate for that? I mean, what is it that they're hearing? I guess it seems obvious, but what's the feedback that they're getting?
Well, so this is something I've been trying to understand, because if you believe these polls, there's been a poll done by Dan Jones and Associates and also by BYU, who claim to be, you know, bipartisan and non-biased, that, you know, 77% of those polled in the state support some kind of health insurance for these folks that are in the coverage gap. The BYU poll, I think, put it at 76%. So it seems as though we're hearing from a majority of the state that they favor some Medicaid expansion. There's been a lot of approval for the governor's Healthy Utah plan. And so when they've had hearings in the past. They've been hearing from the advocacy groups. They've been hearing from people in the coverage gap. They've been hearing from a lot of people that want this expansion. So this is, I think, the first time that I've seen that they're getting a big block of people to come up and publicly say, well, we're opposed to this.
I guess the question is, at what point does it change the political dynamics? I mean, obviously the House doesn't seem to think that their lack of support for this kind of expansion is going to hurt them politically, not at this point.
Well, and it probably has something to do with the fact of the closed-door meeting, right? I mean, they don't have to be held accountable for their views on this if there's not a public vote on it. You know, the bill died, but you know, I don't think you're going to see people rioting in the streets just because there's a strong sort of 76% support. You know,
because of a nebulous caucus vote.
A nebulous caucus vote, and you know, and maybe some people will ask their members how they voted, and maybe some people will change their minds on who they're going to support. But I don't think it's going to be like a groundswell, throw the bums out kind of movement. So I don't know if there's any real long-term political consequences for the House members who opposed this.
You know, the Democrats are certainly trying to spin it. I mean, they've taken every opportunity to say this is a closed-door meeting. You citizens are not being represented. They're saying, I hope people remember this in the next election. And one something that Democrat Rebecca Chavez-Houck said to me is, you know, I think this state is much more centrist than it is being sort of represented by a small group in the House. What she's saying is this group in the House is sort of controlling this decision, whereas the majority of Utahns are actually more centrist on this and on a number of issues. And so she's hoping it will have some sort of political impact in the next election.
What role did the Democrats play at all in this? I guess they can't.
Well,
really, right now,
like Andrea said, I mean, they can be vocal opponents and you know, sort of beat the drum. And I think I would not be at all surprised if you see during the next session that they'll either sponsor a Medicaid expansion bill or a Healthy Utah bill and try to force a vote on it and continue to keep it in the public's attention and in the headlines and try to, you know, push it forward. I mean, obviously there's 12 of them in the House, and it's not likely that they can, you know, muster a coalition to kind of push it forward, you know, push it across the finish line. But they can keep it in the, you know, in the public's awareness and keep it in the headlines to some extent. And probably with the help of the governor, perhaps, you know, keep it on the radar. You know,
this is one of those interesting dynamics because and this is often the case actually in Utah politics where the executive branch, the governor, doesn't get along all that well with with members of the legislature, particularly the House.
Well, I think by the nature of the office, he does sort of have to be more in the middle, right, to represent the entire state. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 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 And there has been some serious tension between governor and, frankly, the speaker over this particular issue. And it was almost a little bit remarkable that they, you know, got together and did these meetings as long as they did and came up with a product that you know, this funding mechanism was, frankly, the speaker's idea. They went along with it. And, you know, again, it just didn't have any possibility of passage. But, you know, they did come to a conclusion. And Senator Niederhauser said that they're going to meet again today and kind of figure out what the next step is going to be.
I wanted to ask you about that. The governor said there are more than one or two or three ways to skin the cat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what kind of proposals could come out? And well, I'll get to this matter that Senator Shiazawa mentioned later, which is this sense of fatigue.
Yeah.
But to talk about that one. What other ways are there skinning this cat, if there are anything out there that could?
Well, during the session, one of the things the Hospital Association threw out there was an increase in the cigarette tax or an e-cigarette tax that could generate at least part of the money. There has been some discussion. Senator Niederhauser actually sees some merit in increasing in restoring the sales tax on food. Part of that was repealed a few years ago, and if you bring back part of that, you can fund it that way. They can raise the sales tax generally on everybody. It'd be about a tenth of a cent increase in the sales tax to generate the $50 million that they would, you know, need to kind of get this program off the ground. So there are other ways that they can look at to pay for this. The question, I think, at this point is, does it matter how you pay for it, or is there opposition in the House Republican caucus among the House conservatives and the Senate conservatives? I don't want to just throw the House members under the bus, but is the opposition among the conservatives such that any mechanism of paying for it will be unacceptable, especially sales tax? I mean, they already raised this last session. They raised the property tax and they raised the gas tax. And now you're going to ask them to raise taxes again, you know, going into an election year. And that's sort of that's for the conservatives in particular. That's a tough sell.
Well, Senator Shizawa talked about the fatigue going on, but he said, you know, it could work both ways. On one hand, it could be people just say, look, I'm sick of this. Let's just leave it alone for now. We don't know what's going to happen next year in the presidential election. Or they could just say, look, we need to get this taken care of. Let's at least pass something. And maybe that means the Utah cares. Maybe that means something else. I mean, where is it tipping? Can you sense at this point? Probably not. But
well, I think it's always a fair bet to kind of bet on the side of inertia when you're dealing with legislative bodies. I think doing nothing – everybody says doing nothing is not an option, but really that's – the easiest option.
Effectively, that's what's happened so
yeah,
far.
Yeah, yeah. An object at rest tends to remain at rest.
It's been 3 years. Right. Let's point that out.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, doing nothing is not only an option, it's the easiest option. And trying to get something moving from, you know, from a stop is going to be difficult. I think there is a potential, though, for this Utah Cares proposal, you know, with the 70-30 match and as the smaller coverage group. And, you know, the argument that gives them a little bit more flexibility, you know, there is a potential for – like I said, that passed the House already once. And, you know, if the senators are like, well, if this is the best we can do, this is the best we can do, and the governor might hold his nose and sign it, that there is some potential for that to kind of get a little momentum.
Would he sign it? Can you tell? Is it too early to say? Be interesting.
It would be interesting. He was very critical of it during the session.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it goes back to the argument of covering fewer people for more money. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense from his perspective. And so, you know, would he sign it? If it's clear that that's the only option, the only way you're going to get this these low income people covered, then maybe that's your best bet.
Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Andrea Smartin, she covers health and business for KUER News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Lindsay Vickers. Josh Weathers is a producer, our producer for Video West. The show, Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.